Meanwhile, Arcesilaus, during this time, being in Samos, was gathering together every man he could for a redistribution of land. And as a great army was being assembled, he set out for Delphi to consult the oracle about his return. The Pythia gave him this response. For 4 Battuses and 4 Arcesilauses, 8 generations of men, Loxias grants your line the kingship of Cyrene, but beyond this, he advises you not even to attempt it. You, however, be at peace when you have returned to your own. And if you find the kiln full of jars, do not fire the jars, but send them away with a favorable wind. But if you fire the kiln, do not enter the land surrounded by water, or else you will die, both you and the finest bull. This is what the Pythia prophesied to Arcesilaus. And he, taking the men from Samos with him, returned to Cyrene, and having gained control of affairs, he did not remember the oracle, but demanded justice from his political opponents for his own exile. Of these, some left the country altogether, while others Arcesilaus seized and sent off to Cyprus for execution. These men were carried off course to Cnidus, and the Cnidians rescued them and sent them off to Thera. But certain others of the Cyrenians who had taken refuge in a great private tower belonging to Aglaomachus, Arcesilaus piled wood around and burned. When he learned, after the deed was done, that this was what the oracle had meant, that the Pythia was warning him not to fire the jars if he found them in the kiln, he willingly kept away from the city of the Cyrenians, fearing the death that had been foretold and believing Cyrene to be the land surrounded by water. Now he had a wife who was his own kinswoman, the daughter of the king of the Barcaeans, whose name was Alasir. He went to him, and certain men of Barca, along with some of the exiles from Cyrene, learned that he was in the marketplace and killed him, and along with him his father-in-law Alasir as well. So Arcesilaus, whether he erred in understanding the oracle willingly or unwillingly, fulfilled his own destiny. As for his mother Pheretime, while Arcesilaus was living in Barca, having brought this evil upon himself, she held her son's honors in Cyrene, administering the rest of his affairs and sitting in the council. But when she learned that her son had died in Barca, she fled and went off to Egypt. For favors had been done by Arcesilaus for Cambyses, son of Cyrus, for it was this Arcesilaus who had given Cyrene to Cambyses and imposed a tribute upon it. So when Pheretime arrived in Egypt, she sat as a suppliant of Arianes, calling on him to avenge her, putting forward as her pretext that her son had died because of his medizing. Now this Arianes was the governor of Egypt appointed by Cambyses, who at a later time, setting himself up as equal to Darius, was destroyed. For learning and seeing that Darius desired to leave behind a memorial of himself such as no other king had achieved, he set out to copy it. And in the end that copying earned him his reward. For Darius had refined gold to the utmost purity and struck coin of it, the purest possible. But Arianes, who ruled Egypt, produced silver coinage by that identical method, and the purest silver money is still called Ariandic today. When Darius learned that he was doing this, he brought another charge against him, that he was rising up against him, and put him to death. But at that time this same Arianes, taking pity on Pheretime, gave her the entire army from Egypt, both infantry and navy. As commander of the infantry, he appointed Amasis, a man of the Marathian people, and of the navy Batters, a man of Pasargadae by birth. But before sending off the army, Arianes sent a herald to Barca to inquire who it was that had killed Arcesilaus. And the Barcaeans themselves all took responsibility, saying that they had suffered many evils at his hands. Learning this, Arianes then sent off the army together with Pheretime. This, then, was the pretext put forward for the expedition, but the army was sent, as it seems to me, for the subjugation of Libya. For there are many and varied peoples of the Libyans, and some of them were subject to the king, only a few, while the greater part paid Darius no heed at all. The Libyans dwell as follows. Beginning from Egypt, the first Libyans settled are the Adiamachidae, who follow for the most part Egyptian customs, but wear the same clothing as the other Libyans do. Their women wear a bronze anklet around each leg, they wear their hair long, and when they catch lice, each woman bites her own in retaliation and thus casts them away. These are the only Libyans who do this, and they alone show to the king the maidens who are about to be married. Whichever one pleases, the king is deflowered by him. These Adiamachidae extend from Egypt as far as the harbor called Plinos. Next to them come the Gilligami, who occupy the land to the west as far as the island of Aphrodisias. In the region between lies the island of Plataea, which the Cyrenians colonized, and on the mainland there is the harbor of Menelaus and Assyrus, where the Cyrenians once lived, and it is from here that Silphium begins to grow. It extends from the island of Plataea to the mouth of the Syades. These people follow customs similar to the others. Next to the Gilligami, to the west, come the Aspisti, who dwell above Cyrene. The Aspisti do not reach the sea, for the coastal land is occupied by the Cyrenians. They are the most skilled chariot drivers of all the Libyans, not the least but the very best, and they make it their practice to imitate most of the customs of the Cyrenians. Next to the Aspisti, to the west, are the Auscasi. These dwell above Barca, reaching down to the sea near Euesperides. In the middle of the Auscasi's territory dwell the Bacchyls, a small people, reaching down to the sea near the city of Tokara in the Barcaean territory. They follow the same customs as those who dwell above Cyrene. Next to these Auscasi, to the west, come the Nasamons, a numerous people, who in summer leave their flocks by the sea and go up into the region of Augila to harvest the dates, which grow there abundantly and widely spread, all of them fruit-bearing. When they catch locusts, they dry them in the sun and grind them up, and then sprinkle them over milk and drink it. Each man is thought to have numerous wives, and the women are shared in common among them, following a custom much like that of the Massageti. Whenever a man plants his staff before a tent, they come together. It is the custom, at the first marriage of a Nasamonian man, for the bride on the first night to pass through all the guests in turn, having intercourse with each. And each one, as he has intercourse with her, gives her whatever gift he happens to have brought from his house. This is how they take oaths and divine the future. Touching the tombs of those among them reputed to have been the most just and finest men, they swear by them. And they practice divination by going to the tombs of their ancestors, and after praying they lie down to sleep upon them. Whatever they see in a dream, that is what they act upon. To seal a pledge of good faith, they use this method. Each gives the other something to drink poured from his own hand, and drinks likewise from the other's hand. Should no liquid be available, they scoop up dust from the ground instead and lick it. Bordering the Nasamons are the Psylli. These came to a complete end in this manner. A wind out of the south dried up the reservoirs of water, and their entire land, lying within the Syades, became waterless. They, taking counsel together, marched out against the south wind, I tell this as the Libyans tell it, and when they came into the sand, the south wind blew and buried them. With these destroyed, the Nasamons now hold their land. Above these, toward the south wind, in the land full of wild beasts, dwell the Garamantes, who avoid every man and all human company, and own no weapon meant for war, and have no notion of how to defend themselves. These then dwell above the Nasamons. Along the sea, to the west, come the Maci, who shave their heads in a peculiar fashion, letting the middle of the hair grow long while shaving it close on either side, and for war they carry as shields the skins of ostriches. Through their land flows the river Sinops, running down to the sea from a rise known as the Hill of the Graces. This Hill of the Graces is thickly wooded, whereas the rest of Libya described above is bare. From the sea to it is 200 stadia. Next to these Maci come the Gindanes, whose women each wear many leather anklets, as is said, for the following reason. For each man she has had intercourse with, she ties on an anklet, and the woman with the most anklets is judged the finest, since more men than any other have desired her. On a headland projecting into the sea from the territory of these Gindanes dwell the lotus eaters, who live on the fruit of the lotus alone. The fruit of the lotus is about the size of the mastic tree's fruit, and in sweetness it resembles the fruit of the date palm. The lotus eaters also make wine from this fruit. Next to the lotus eaters, along the sea, come the Machlis, who also use the lotus, though less than those mentioned before. They extend down to a great river called the Triton, which flows into a great lake, the Tritonus. In this lake there is an island called Phla. It is said that there was an oracle for the Lacedaemonians to colonize this island. There is also this other story told, that Jason, when the Argo had been built for him under Mount Pelion, and he had put aboard it, along with another hecatomb, a bronze tripod, sailed around the Peloponnese, wishing to reach Delphi. And as he was sailing, when he came off Cape Malea, a north wind caught him and carried him off toward Libya, and before he sighted land, he found himself among the shallows of Lake Tritonus. and while he was at a loss how to find his way out, the story goes that Triton appeared and asked Jason for the tripod in return, promising to reveal the way through and send them off unharmed. Jason agreeing, Triton then showed them the channel through the shallows and placed the tripod within his own shrine, and having pronounced a prophecy over the tripod, he declared to those with Jason the whole matter, that whenever one of the descendants of those who had sailed together on the Argo should carry off the tripod, then it would be an absolute necessity for 100 Greek cities to be built around Lake Tritonis. Hearing this, the local people of the Libyans to hide the tripod. Among these, the Ossians live along with the Machlis. Both these peoples and the Machlis dwell around Lake Tritonis, with the Triton River as their boundary. The Machlis grow their hair long behind, while the Ossians wear it long in front. At the yearly festival of Athena, their maidens divide into two groups and fight one another with stones and sticks, saying that in doing so they are performing the rites of their ancestral goddess, whom we call Athena. Any maidens who die of their wounds they call false maidens. Before they let the girls fight, they do the following together. The maiden judged most beautiful on each occasion is dressed in a Corinthian helmet and full Greek armor, set up on a chariot, and led around the lake in a circle. In earlier times, before Greeks came to settle among them, I cannot say how they used to dress the maidens, but I suppose they were dressed in Egyptian armor, for I hold that both the shield and the helmet reached the Greeks from Egypt. As for Athena, they say she is the daughter of Poseidon and of Lake Tritonis, and that, having some grievance against her father, she gave herself to Zeus, who then made her his own daughter. This is what they say. As for marriage, they hold women in common, neither living in pairs nor forming settled unions, but coupling like herd animals. When a woman's child has grown sturdy, the men gather together in the third month, and whichever man the child resembles is reckoned as its father. These, then, are the coastal nomadic Libyans I have described. Above them, further inland, lies the wild beast country of Libya, and beyond that wild region a ridge of sand stretches from Egyptian Thebes to the Pillars of Heracles. Along this ridge, roughly every 10 days' journey, one finds lumps of salt in great chunks, heaped in mounds, and at the top of each mound cold, sweet water spurts up from the middle of the salt, and around it live people at the edge of the desert, beyond the wild beast region. First, 10 days' journey from Thebes, the Ammonians, who have their sanctuary derived from the Zeus of Thebes. For indeed the statue of Zeus at Thebes, as I have said before, has a ram's face. They also happen to have another spring of water, which at dawn is lukewarm, grows colder as the marketplace fills, and by midday is very cold indeed. At that time they water their gardens with it. As the day declines, it loses its coldness, until at sunset the water becomes lukewarm again. As it moves further toward the hot, it approaches boiling around midnight, at which point it bubbles up in surges, then midnight passes and it cools again until dawn. This spring is called the spring of the sun. After the Ammonians, another 10 days' journey further along the sandy ridge, there is a salt mound like the one at Ammon, with water as well, and people living around it. The name of this place is Augila. It is to this place that the Nasamons go to gather dates in season. From Augila, another 10 days' journey away, there is yet another salt mound with water and many fruit-bearing date palms, just as at the other places. And people live there, whose name is the Garamantes, a very powerful people, who spread earth over the salt and so plant their crops in it. The shortest route to the lotus eaters is 30 days' journey from them. Among these people are also found the backward grazing cattle. They are called backward grazing for this reason. Their horns curve forward, and because of this they walk backward as they graze, since they cannot move forward while their horns are jabbing into the ground ahead of them. Apart from this trait, and the thick, tough hide they carry, nothing else sets them apart from ordinary cattle. These Garamantes chase down the cave-dwelling Ethiopians using chariots drawn by 4 horses, for among all the men we have reports of, none run faster than these cave-dwelling Ethiopians. The cave-dwellers eat snakes and lizards and other such creeping things, and their language resembles no other, but is a kind of squeaking like that of bats. Beyond the Garamantes, another 10 days' journey away, there is yet another salt mound and water, and people living around it whose name is the Adirantes, who alone of all men we know are without individual names. For as a group they are called Adirantes, but no single name is assigned to any one of them. they curse the sun as it rises overhead, and besides this, they heap on it every kind of abuse, because, they say, it scorches and destroys them, both themselves and their land. Then, another 10 days' journey further, there is another salt mound and water with people living around it. Adjoining this salt deposit is a mountain called Atlas, which is narrow and perfectly conical in shape, and so high, it is said, that its peaks cannot be seen, for clouds never leave them, neither in summer nor in winter. The local people say this is the Pillar of Heaven. It is after this mountain that these people take their name, for they are called the Atlantes. It is said that they eat nothing that has life in it, and that they see no dreams. As far as these Atlantes, I am able to list the names of the peoples settled along the ridge, but beyond them I can no longer do so. The ridge stretches all the way to the pillars of Heracles and beyond. There is a salt mine within it, 10 days' journey further on, with people living there. The houses of all these people are built out of blocks of salt, since this part of Libya gets no rain at all, for the walls, being made of salt, could not stand if it rained. The salt quarried there is of two kinds, white and purple. Beyond this ridge, to the south and toward the interior of Libya, the land is desert, waterless, without animals, without rain, and without trees, and there is no moisture in it at all. So it is, then, that as far as Lake Tritonis, going from Egypt, the Libyans are nomads who eat meat and drink milk. They do not touch the flesh of cows, just as the Egyptians do not, and they do not keep pigs. Even the women of Cyrene do not think it right to eat the flesh of cows, on account of the Egyptian Isis, and they observe fasts and festivals in her honor. The women of Barca, meanwhile, refrain from eating pork as well as beef. Such, then, is the state of things there. West of Lake Tritonis, the Libyans are no longer nomads, nor do they follow the same customs, nor do they treat their children as the nomads are accustomed to do. Whether every nomadic Libyan follows this practice is something I am unable to state with certainty, though a good number of them do the following. When a child of theirs reaches the age of 4, they burn the veins at the crown of its head with a tuft of sheep's wool. Some of them burn the veins at the temples instead, so that for the rest of its life, no phlegm running down from the head may harm it. And because of this, they say, they are the healthiest of people. Indeed, the Libyans truly are the healthiest of all men we know. Whether it is because of this practice, I cannot say for certain, but healthiest they are. And if the children suffer convulsions while being burned, they have found a remedy for this too. They sprinkle them with the urine of a he-goat, and by this cure them. What follows is simply what the Libyans themselves report. The nomad sacrifices are as follows. When they have cut a piece from the ear of the animal, they throw it over the roof of the house, and once this is done, they wring its neck back. The sun and the moon alone receive their sacrifices. All Libyans sacrifice to these, but those who live around Lake Tritonis sacrifice chiefly to Athena, and after her to Triton and Poseidon. As for the dress and the aegis of the statues of Athena, the Greeks took these from the Libyan women. Except that the Libyan women's dress is of leather, and the tassels hanging from their aegis are not snakes, but thongs. In all other respects, the dress is fashioned in the same way. And indeed, the very name testifies that the costume of the images of Pallas comes from Libya, for the Libyan women wear bare goatskins about their dress, fringed and dyed red with madder, and it is from these goatskins that the Greeks derived the name aegis. It seems to me, too, that the ritual cry raised in sacred rites first arose there, for the Libyan women use it very skillfully and often. The Greeks also learned from the Libyans how to yoke 4 horses together. The nomads bury their dead as the Greeks do, except for the Nasamons. These bury their dead sitting up, taking care, as the person is about to breathe their last, to sit them upright so that they do not die lying flat on their back. Their dwellings are woven together out of asphodel stalks bound around reeds, and these are portable. That is the way of life these people keep to. West of the Triton River, next to the Ossians, are Libyans who are already farmers and who are accustomed to owning houses. Their name is the Maxis. These grow the hair long on the right side of the head and shave it away on the left, and they smear their bodies with red ochre. They say that they are descended from the men of Troy. This land, and the rest of Libya toward the west, is far more full of wild beasts and more thickly wooded than the land of the nomads. For the eastern part of Libya, which the nomads inhabit, is low-lying and sandy as far as the Triton River, while the land beyond west of this region, the land of the plowing peoples, is very mountainous, thickly wooded, and full of wild animals. For there are the huge snakes and lions of that region, and elephants and bears and asps and donkeys with horns, and the dog-headed creatures and the headless beings that have their eyes in their chests. As the Libyans say they do, wild-natured men, wild-natured women, and a great number of other creatures too real to be mere invention. Among the nomads, however, none of these exist, but rather these. White-rumped antelopes, gazelles, hartebeest, and donkeys, not the horned kind, but others that never drink water, for indeed they do not drink, and oryxes, whose horns the Phoenicians make into the curved handles of lyres. This animal is the size of an ox, and jackal foxes and hyenas and porcupines and wild rams and nets and jackals and panthers and boris and crocodiles on land about 3 cubits long, most similar to lizards, and ostriches that burrow in the ground. And small snakes, each having a single horn. These, then, are the animals found there, and those that exist elsewhere too, except for deer and wild boar, for deer and wild boar do not exist in Libya at all. There are 3 kinds of mice there. Some are called two-footed, others zedgeries, this name is Libyan, and in the Greek tongue it means hills, and others hedgehog mice. There are also weasels living among the silphium plants, most similar to the Tartessian weasels. So many, then, are the animals that the land of the nomadic Libyans has, as far as we, through our inquiry, have been able to reach in our research. Next to the Maxis of Libya come the Zoics, among whom the women drive the chariots into war. Next to these come the Gizontes, among whom bees produce a great deal of honey, and still more, it is said, is made by craftsmen. All these people daub themselves with red ochre, and monkeys, plentiful in their mountains, form part of their diet. Near these, the Carthaginians say, lies an island called Cyrenes, 200 stadia in length and narrow in width, reachable on foot from the mainland, full of olive trees and vines. There is a lake in it, from which the local maidens, using feathers of birds smeared with pitch, bring up gold dust from the mud. Whether this is really true, I do not know, but I write what is said. It could all be true, since I myself have seen, in Zacynthus, pitch being brought up from a lake and water. There are indeed several lakes there, and the largest of them is 70 feet across in every direction, and 2 fathoms deep. Into this, they let down a pole with a myrtle branch tied to its tip, and then they bring up pitch on the myrtle, having a smell like asphalt but otherwise better than Pyrian pitch. They pour it into a pit dug near the lake, and when they have gathered a good amount, they then pour it from the pit into jars. Whatever falls into the lake passes underground and reappears in the sea, which is about 4 stadia from the lake. So then, what is said about the island lying off Libya is also plausible in light of this truth. The Carthaginians also tell this story. Beyond the Pillars of Heracles lies a region of Libya inhabited by people, that when they arrive among them and unload their cargo, having set it out in a row along the shore, they board their ships and raise smoke. The local inhabitants notice the smoke, make their way down to the shore, and lay out gold as payment for the goods, and withdraw far back from the goods. The Carthaginians then disembark and inspect it, and if the gold seems to them a fair price for the goods, they take it and depart. But if it does not seem enough, they board their ships again and sit there. The others then come and set down more gold, until they satisfy them. Neither side wrongs the other, for the Carthaginians do not touch the gold until it equals in value the worth of the goods, nor do the others touch the goods until the Carthaginians have taken the gold. These, then, make up the Libyan peoples that we can identify by name, and among these most of them, neither now nor then, gave any thought at all to the king of the Medes. This much more I can say about this land, that 4 peoples inhabit it and no more than these, as far as we know, and 2 of these peoples are native and 2 are not. The Libyans and the Ethiopians are native, the former living in the northern part and the latter in the southern part of Libya, while the Phoenicians and Greeks are settlers there. It seems to me that Libya has no fertility worth comparing to either Asia or Europe, except for the region of Sinope alone, for that land bears the same name as its river. This land is like the best land for bringing forth the crop of Demeter, and it is nothing at all like the rest of Libya. Its soil is black and fed by springs, suffering neither drought nor harm from excess rain, for rain does indeed fall in that part of Libya. the measures of the yield of its crop are the same as those established for the land of Babylon. Good land, too, is that which the people of Uisparides occupy. When it bears its very best, it yields 100-fold, while the land in Sinops yields 300-fold. The land of Cyrene also, being the highest part of this Libya which the nomads occupy, has three seasons within itself worthy of wonder. First, the crops near the coast come into season for reaping and harvesting. Once these are gathered in, the crops of the middle region above the coastal lands come into season for harvesting, the region they call the hills. This middle crop having been gathered in, the crop in the highest part of the land also ripens and comes into season, with the result that the first crop is already consumed and gone before the last one comes in alongside it. Thus the harvest season occupies the Cyreneans for 8 months. Let this much, then, be said on this subject. The Persian avengers of Pharatime, after they had been sent from Egypt by Arianes and arrived at Barca, laid siege to the city, demanding that they hand over those responsible for the murder of Arcesilaus. But since the whole population was implicated, they did not accept the terms. Then they besieged Barca for 9 months, digging underground tunnels leading to the wall and making violent assaults. The tunnels were discovered by a bronze smith by means of a bronze shield, having conceived the idea as follows. Carrying it around inside the wall, he pressed it against the ground of the city. Everywhere else it pressed against the ground it made no sound, but wherever there was digging underneath, the bronze of the shield rang out. Digging counter tunnels at that point, the people of Barca killed the Persians who were tunneling there. This, then, is how it was discovered, and the assaults the Barcaeans beat back. When much time had been spent, and many had fallen on both sides, no fewer among the Persians, Amasis, the commander of the infantry, devised the following scheme. Realizing that the Barcaeans could not be taken by force, but could be taken by trickery, he did this. By night he dug a wide trench and laid weak timbers across it, and over the timbers he laid down a covering of soil, so that the ground looked even with everything around it. At daybreak he invited the Barcaeans to a parley, and they gladly agreed, until it was decided to make use of an agreement. The agreement they made was of this sort. Cutting the oath over the hidden trench, that as long as this ground remained as it was, the oath would remain in force, and that the Barcaeans would agree to pay a tribute worthy to the king, and the Persians would do nothing else new against the Barcaeans. After the oath, the Barcaeans, trusting in these terms, themselves came out of the city, and allowed any of the enemy who wished to enter within the wall, opening all the gates. But the Persians broke through the hidden bridge and ran inside the wall. They broke through the bridge they had made for this reason, so that they might keep faith with their oath, since they had sworn to the Barcaeans that the oath would remain in force for as long as the ground remained as it then was. Once they had broken it through, the oath no longer remained in force as it stood. Pharatime then, once the most guilty of the Barcaeans had been handed over to her by the Persians, had them impaled in a circle around the wall. Their wives' breasts she cut off and fixed those around the wall as well, in a ring. The rest of the Barcaeans she ordered the Persians to take as plunder, except for those who were of the house of Battus and were not implicated in the murder. To these Pharatime entrusted the city. The rest of the Barcaeans, then, the Persians enslaved and led away. And when they arrived before the city of Cyrene, the Cyreneans, in fear of some oracle, let them pass through the city. As the army was passing through, Battus, the commander of the naval force, urged that they take the city, but Amasis, commander of the infantry, would not allow it, saying that they had been sent out against Barca alone, the only Greek city they were to attack. But once they had passed through and settled on the hill of Zeus Lycaeus, they regretted not having seized Cyrene, and they tried a second time to enter it. But the Cyreneans would not let them. Then, with no one fighting against the Persians, fear fell upon them, and they fled some 60 stadia and made camp there. And while the army was encamped there, a messenger came from Arianes recalling them. The Persians then asked the Cyreneans to give them provisions for the road, and having received these, they departed for Egypt. From there the Libyans took over, and for the sake of their clothing and gear killed those of them who lagged behind and straggled, until they came to Egypt. This Persian army went farther into Libya than any other, as far as Uisparides. As for the Barcaeans they had enslaved, they carried them off from Egypt to the king, and King Darius gave them a village in Bactrian territory to settle in. They gave this village the name Bars, and it was still inhabited in the land of Bactria down to my own time. As for Pharatime, she too did not finish out her life well. Once she had made her way back to Egypt from Libya after avenging herself on the Barkeans, she died a horrible death. While still alive, she seethed and swarmed with worms, since it seems that excessively severe vengeance taken by human beings provokes the resentment of the gods. Such, then, and so great was the vengeance that came from Pharatime, daughter of Battus, upon the Barkeans.